Morning, turn to Deuteronomy chapter 8 and verse 18. We've already read this at least once, maybe a couple times in this series thus far, but I'd like to start the message with this for the direction that we'll be taking in this particular message. Deuteronomy chapter 8 and verse 18. It says, "But thou shalt remember Yahweh thy God, for it is He that giveth thee power to get wealth, that He may establish His covenant which He sware unto thy fathers, as it is this day." This will once again be principles of Bible economics, and this is part four. In the previous two messages, I provided you with what I hope to be sufficient warning from the Bible concerning wealth wrongly accumulated and or wrong perspectives regarding money. Enough so that as to make you cautious, calculated, guarded, and even wary about how you approach this particular subject of concerning wealth and riches and so forth. Once again, better to be rich in the unseen things and poor in the seen things than vice versa. And we could go on and spend some time on that again, but I won't do that. However, hopefully, not so cautious about that. Again, I hope I have used those two messages have been used to indeed make us cautious. We indeed need to be cautious because there is more in the Bible that's from a negative perspective than there is in a positive perspective. At least direct statements, I can say that. And therefore, God wants us. He came at it from several different angles to make sure that we understand that there is indeed dangers that do sometimes accompany wealth and riches. However, even though I truly hope that those messages have made you cautious and possibly even wary, that at the same time that they haven't made you so cautious that you don't want anything at all to do with money or wealth other than what's necessarily to simply subsist upon. Now, that may be God's plan for your life. Let's understand that as well. It's not God's plan for everyone to be rich and wealthy. But the point also might be made is that it may be God's plan for your life to be rich and wealthy, and you're subverting Him because of the wrong attitudes about wealth and money as well. Now, once again, not so cautious that you don't want anything. I hope that it hasn't made you so cautious that you don't want anything to do with money, except for what you need to live, make it, you know, daily live upon. Because let me assure you that that is precisely the attitude, the posture that a master wants his servant to have. And regrettably, that is precisely the stance that most Christians have as it pertains to money. And therefore, as already pointed out, economics, for the most part, is just another aspect of the kingdom that has been relegated to the non-Christians and the Antichrist, at least for the most part, and who have therefore, for the most part, become the masters with most Christians serving them as their slaves, without most people even realizing that that's what's happened to them. Therefore, in this message, I want to balance the warnings, the negative admonitions of the Scriptures with some of the positive admonitions found in the Bible regarding money and wealth. Far too many Christians are aware or have only had the negative aspect of money and wealth shared with them. It's time that they hear the positive side from the Scriptures on this very important area of life and dominion. Not just life. It's important enough for that, but this is also an extremely important area as it concerns dominion as well. I began this message with Deuteronomy 8:18, again, that declares that Yahweh is the one who empowers His people to get wealth. Therefore, wealth, when properly approached, cannot be evil in itself. Again, it's not money that's the root of all evil. It's the love of money that's the root of all evil. And again, from that verse alone, we should be able to see that wealth or money is not evil in itself, because it's something that Yahweh rewards His people with when they serve Him and obey His laws. Wealth in its many forms is the result, is the outcome of keeping and implementing the laws of Yahweh, especially on a national basis. Take North America, for example, compared to South America. You know, when you really think about the two continents, there's not a whole lot of difference other than one's on one side of the equator and the other's on the other side. The terrain is much the same. The land mass is very similar. The mineral wealth, the natural wealth, the wealth of those two nations are very, very comparable to each other. But take North America, for example, compared to South America, or North America, for example, compared to South America, became great and much more prosperous than South America did. But not because of our own ingenuity and endeavors, but rather because those who came to our shores came searching for God and not gold. Now, in other words, gold, I mean, we're talking about how prosperous we did become. Gold, if you will, just using that as a synonym for wealth, gold was not the result, was the result, not the goal. And that, not even on a grand scale, as we're talking about continents, should again prove points that I've tried to previously bring home to you. Modern America right now, let me tell you, would do well to remember that our greatness and that our wealth and all that we've been able to do is because our people came here looking for God and not for gold. They found gold, but it was a result of them finding God. And modern America better take stock of that before what greatness she has left is lost as she travels down the road to destruction that so many other nations have traveled before her. And she thinks it could never happen to America. Well, let me guarantee you, Rome thought it could never happen to Rome either. Greece thought it could never happen to Greece. Babylon thought it could never happen to Babylon either. And don't think that it'll be any different for us. And America better take stock that we have got to go back to our roots of seeking God first, and then we might be able therein, by His grace and mercy, to retain our greatness and our wealth that He has so blessed us with. Consider the warning the Israelites were given prior to being told that it was Yahweh who made them wealthy. Back to Deuteronomy chapter 8, we've read verse 18 of this verse two or three times. I don't know that I've read what comes previous to this. Let's start with verse 10. Verse 10, it says, "When thou hast eaten and art full, then thou shalt bless Yahweh thy God for the good land which He has given thee." By the way, money isn't wealth. Money is money. Our money is not money, but money is money. But money, don't think that money is wealth. Money is what you use to obtain wealth. And land is wealth. Let's understand that too. Land and other things of that type. Land is about one of the things that provides the most wealth, or can be described as wealth, probably more than anything else. Why do you think our government wants it all? Why do you think they're trying to accumulate every bit of it they can? Because there's great wealth in land. So there's wealth. He's talking about wealth here. And then he says, "Beware that thou forget not Yahweh thy God in not keeping His commandments and His judgments and His statutes which I command thee this day, lest when thou hast eaten and art full and hast built good goodly houses and dwelt therein, and when thy herds and thy flocks multiply and thy silver and thy gold is multiplied and all that thou hast is multiplied." Now, are we talking about wealth? I mean, their flocks, their children, but their flocks and herds and their silver and their gold and all that thou hast is multiplied. He talks about it. Where did it come from? It came from God. He says, he can't go back to verse 10. "When thou hast eaten and art full, then thou shalt bless Yahweh." Verse 11, "Beware that thou forget not Yahweh thy God because it was Yahweh who'd given it all to them. It's interesting how so often, whereas God is the one who blesses a nation or a person or an individual with wealth, it's the wealth then that seems to remove them from their God. And so this is just one of many warnings of this type throughout the Scriptures. Verse 14, it says, "And then thy heart be lifted up, and thou forget Yahweh thy God, which brought thee forth out of the land of Egypt from the house of bondage, who led thee through that great and terrible wilderness wherein were fiery serpents and scorpions and drought, where there was no water, who brought thee forth water out of the rock of flint, who fed thee in the wilderness with manna, which thy fathers knew not, that he might humble thee, and that he might prove thee to do thee good at thy latter end." Verse 17, "And thou say in thy heart..." Now, stop right there. Let's go back first before we actually read that. Verse 13 again, or verse 11, first part. "Beware that thou forget not Yahweh thy God." And then he goes through all the rest of what I just read, and then he gets to the point again, and he says, "And that thou say not in thy heart, my power and the might of my hand has gotten me this wealth." Now, see, that's all that precedes verse 18. That's the point he's trying to get across. We need to realize it's not by our hand. It's not by our power. Never has been in America and never will be. For America as a nation or us as an individual, that it's by our power and our might and our ingenuity and our wisdom. Even all of that is a gift from God. You think we'd have that if he hadn't blessed us with it? Wasn't it God who said to Moses, "Who is it that makes the deaf, you know, so that he can't hear, or the blind so that he cannot see, or the man who gives him his sight, who gives him the ability to speak, who gives him his mind, who gives him his ingenuity?" It's always God. And then it comes down to verse 18, "But thou shalt remember Yahweh thy God, for it is he that giveth thee power to give thee wealth, that he may establish his covenant, which he sware unto to your fathers, as it is this day." Ah, America needs to take stock. And each of us do individually to those words as well. That it is not by our power. And if God in any deeds, I mean, we are a wealthy people, but whether it be the wealth we already have in whatever regard, or if he, through the principles that I share with you, or for whatever other reason, if God blesses us with wealth, we need to take stock and realize and let that wealth be instead of that which removes us from our God, that it be the very thing that brings us to his throne on our knees to humbly thank him and praise him for all that he's given us. You know, the very first time, again, going on to the positive admonitions, and again, verse 18 couldn't be any clearer that God, for the wealth comes from God. If God gives us the ability to make wealth, then wealth in and of itself certainly cannot be a negative, cannot be evil in itself. The very first time that Zahab, the Hebrew word for gold, that is, / real money, is found in the Bible is in Genesis chapter 2 and verse 12. Let's turn there, if you would. Genesis chapter 2, and actually we'll start with verse 8. Genesis 2, verse 8. It says, "And out of the ground..." Excuse me. "And Yahweh God planted a garden eastward in Eden. There he put the man whom he had formed. And out of the ground made Yahweh God to grow every tree that is pleasant to the sight and good for food, the tree of life also in the midst of the garden." And we're talking about the things that God originally in his creation put in this garden. And catch this thing, too. The things that... Of all the things that are in this garden, these are the things that he has chosen in his word to describe this garden with. Again, verse 9, "And out of the garden made Yahweh God to grow every tree that is pleasant to the sight and good for food, the tree of life also in the midst of the garden, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And a river went out of the Eden to water the garden, and from thence it was parted and became into four heads. The name of the first is Pison, that is, it which compasseth the whole land of Havilah, where there is gold. And the gold of that land is good. And there is bedlam and oinkstone," and so forth, and it continues on in that description. But note that it says in verse 12 that there is gold at this particular juncture, God chose, in describing the garden, to mention gold. And he says, and the gold is good. Now, that can be interpreted in different ways. The fact is, gold, he does use the term, and by the way, the word translated good there, it's the same word that's translated good in the phrase, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. He says the gold is good. In other words, it was useful. It had a purpose. God understood. He put it there because there was a use for gold and some of these other things that are mentioned. So the gold is mentioned there as being good. The first time that gold and silver is mentioned as a possession of someone is found in Genesis 13. Turn there, if you will. Genesis 13 and verses 1 and 2. It says, and Abram went up out of Egypt, he and his wife and all that he had, and Lot with him into the south, or into the Negev. And Abram was very rich. Your version, if you're reading a different version than King James, I think New American Standard says exceedingly rich. And Abraham was very, or exceedingly rich in cattle, in silver, and in gold. That's the first time that gold and silver is mentioned in the Bible as being a possession of someone. Now, you can't tie hard and fast on this, but it is often the case that the very first time something is mentioned, that it gives a perspective on it, at least to some extent, throughout the rest of the Scriptures. Again, you can't tie hard and fast on that, but it seems to be the case in many things. For example, the first time that the kingdom is mentioned is in Exodus 19, when Yahweh married Israel. There's a very important thing there's a very important reason, as I've shared with you in the past, why the kingdom is mentioned first in that particular instance and all the implications. We won't get into that. But it is interesting. Here is the first time that gold and silver is mentioned as a possession of someone in the Bible. And certainly it's talking about the wealth of Abraham. But Abraham wasn't the only one of God's great men of the past who had great wealth. Isaac, Jacob, David, Solomon. Talk about wealth. How about Job? Certainly a very extremely wealthy man, lost it all. God gave it back to him many times fold over again. Boaz, the grandfather, great-grandfather of David, who took Ruth as his wife. Of Boaz it says that he was a mighty man of wealth. Great man of wealth. Joseph prospered even while in Egyptian slavery. In Genesis 39, 2 and 3 it says, and Yahweh was with Joseph, and he was a prosperous man. Even, we're talking about while in slavery. God made him prosperous. And Yahweh was with Joseph, and he was a prosperous man, and he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. And his master saw that Yahweh was with him, and that Yahweh made all that he did to prosper in his hand. So even while in Potiphar's, as a slave in Potiphar's house, God makes Joseph prosperous and wealthy. And even that didn't compare with what the wealth that he was yet to have when he becomes second in the land to Pharaoh himself. Talk about a wealthy man. Yet he was still a slave. Still in slavery. Still bound to that land. And God yet still blessed him. Now back to Genesis chapter 3. And this statement that this first time that we find silver and gold as a possession of someone, in this case Abram. Several years ago I remember reading a Christian author who looked at Abraham's silver and gold as a curse. I can't tell you what book it was, I can't tell you what author it was, but I remember this very clearly, and it probably 15, 20 years ago when I read this. But he looked at Abraham's gold and silver as a curse rather than a blessing, associating these riches with the fact that he'd just come from Egypt. And Egypt meant something bad and evil to this man, and out of God's plan somehow. What a negative perspective. I mean, you cannot find that from the verse itself. That has to be read into the verse. And therefore, what a negative perspective on that particular passage. Why not instead interpret Abram's riches as a blessing from Yahweh for Abraham's faithfulness and obedience to Yahweh. After all, isn't that what God promised Abram? Look at go back to Genesis 12, 1 through 3. It says, "And now Yahweh had said unto Abram, Get thee out of thy country, and from thy kindred, and from thy father's house, unto a land that I will show thee. And I will make of thee a great nation, and I will bless thee, and make thy name great, and thou shalt be a blessing. And I will bless them that bless thee, and I will curse them that curses thee. And in thee shall all the families of the earth be blessed." One of the indications of who his descendants are is that when in obedience to God, that they have been blessed so greatly, they have so much wealth in so many different areas that they bless the rest of the world with their wealth. And even so, even when they're not so obedient, as it is today in America, we're still blessing the rest of the world in many ways, because of the overabundance of wealth that God has blessed Abraham and therefore on, as it's extended on to his servants. That's what God promised Abram, that he would bless him and make him a great and mighty, wealthy nation. I wouldn't be surprised that, in fact, Abraham was much more wealthy, in fact, when he left Egypt than when he went in. Now, he was a wealthy man before he went in, but I wouldn't be surprised if he was more wealthy when he came out of Egypt in this instance. Just as the Israelites were when they spoiled the Egyptians before departing Egypt to the Promised Land, several hundred years later. In fact, knowing the way that Yahweh operates with his people, I would be surprised if Abraham wasn't more wealthy when he left Egypt than when he entered Egypt. That's the way our God works, at least when one is obedient to him. Now, did Abraham make some mistakes while in Egypt? You bet he did. But did that make him absolutely so displeasing to God that he cursed him with gold and silver? I don't think so. I think he probably walked out with a lot of the Egyptians' gold and silver because God blessed him. By his grace, he covered his sin, and he blessed him with even more because he looked to Abraham as his friend, as he's described. In fact, I think Abraham's the only one described as God's friend in the Bible. Indeed, I'll get it through your heads again, wealth can be a curse. Let's not also miss the fact that it is sometimes also a blessing from Yahweh. Proverbs 10:22, for example, listen to this. It says, the blessing of Yahweh, it maketh rich, and he addeth no sorrow with it. In other words, sorrow often, I might say usually, does accompany riches. When it's procured on our own, and when Yahweh and his kingdom are left out of the equation. More often than not, sorrow does accompany such riches under such circumstances. But when Yahweh is involved and blesses a man with the ability to make wealth, when he blesses them, it is indeed just that, a blessing, not a curse, as was suggested by this particular author that I read so many years ago. Isn't that what Deuteronomy 28 is all about? Deuteronomy 28 is all about wealth. Or no wealth. That's the blessings and that's the curses. Now, it's really all about serving God or not serving God. But the point is, of Deuteronomy 28, is that God blesses us with wealth. When, especially in a national sense, doesn't always use individuals in that sense, but blesses his people with wealth when they serve him, when he is a part of their equation. He will bless them with wealth, and therefore wealth in and of itself cannot be something negative when it comes to us as Christians. Turn to Ecclesiastes chapter 5. Ecclesiastes Ecclesiastes chapter 5, and verse 13. Verse 13, it says, then there is sore evil, there is a sore evil which I have seen under the sun, namely, this is an evil, namely, riches kept for the owners thereof to their hurt. New American Standard is a little bit easier to read. It says, there is a grievous evil which I have seen under the sun, riches being hoarded by the owner to his hurt. But wait a minute, I thought this message was supposed to be on the positive side of wealth. That's not very positive. Well, no, it isn't. But note the emphasis of that verse and why it's negative. And then note the balance to that verse. That's so many Christians today and even preachers today, when it comes to the issue of money and wealth, seem to completely miss. The balance is provided to us in verses 18 and 19. Chapter 5. Verse 18, behold, that which have I seen, it is good and comely for one to eat, to drink, and to enjoy the good of all his labor that he taketh under the sun all the days of his life, which God giveth him, for it is his portion. Verse 19, every man also to whom God has given riches and wealth, and hath given him power to eat thereof, and to take his portion, and to rejoice in his labor, this is the gift of God. Now, I want to tell you, Ecclesiastes is a hard book to understand unless you look at it from the perspective of balance. I mean, if you take one statement in and of itself, you're going to have an imbalanced approach. It was like Solomon, he takes the one side, and then he takes the totally opposite side, and hopefully in between the two, you get the balance of it all. The point of the balance of these two passages is the perspective upon them. The first man, described in verse 13, accumulated, hoarded his wealth to himself. It was for building his own kingdom. The latter man was obviously blessed with wealth as a resulting of seeking first Yahweh and his kingdom. Can you see the difference? Hopefully, I'm sure you can. Turn to Psalms 112. Psalms 112. Psalms 112, verses 1 through 3. It says, praise ye Yahweh. Blessed is the man that feareth Yahweh, that delighteth greatly in his commandments. His seed shall be mighty upon the earth. Let me stop there for a moment. We're talking about wealth and riches and prosperity and in other forms. But again, there's real wealth, and then there's this other wealth that can be used for other purposes. But you want to talk about real wealth. Therein is described real wealth. His seed or his descendants shall be mighty upon the earth. Therein is a man's real wealth. Arrows as they're described, a man who has a quiver full of arrows that go beyond. You know, an arrow, as I pointed out, an arrow is that, children are described as the arrows, is what I'm talking about. And an arrow can go where a mighty man cannot. He can go over a wall that's been built that he can't get around or get over. But the arrow can go where a mighty man is looking ahead and looking to the future and seeing that we want our descendants to be great and mighty. Now, there's real wealth, but there's more. His seed shall be mighty upon the earth. The generation of the upright shall be blessed. Verse 3, wealth and riches shall be in his house, and his righteousness endureth forever. Proverbs 15:6 says, in the house of the righteous is much treasure. Is that positive or is that negative? Is that a curse or is that a blessing? It appears to be a blessing. In the house of the righteous is much treasure, but in the revenues of the wicked is trouble. And again in verse 27, he that is greedy of gain troubleth his own house. Again, the balance of the scriptures there. And it all has to do with perspective and with our reason for pursuing wealth, for what we're using it for whose kingdom we're building it. In other words, it's a curse on man when his riches are accumulated for his own purposes, but they are a blessing from Yahweh when wealth is the result of serving Yahweh and for the purpose of furthering his kingdom. Turn to Ecclesiastes 10. This is a very interesting word. One of those again in Ecclesiastes from Solomon that you really need to understand within the whole context of the whole book. But Ecclesiastes chapter 10. I lost my place here. What verse was it? Ecclesiastes 10 and verse 19. Interesting verse. Listen to what it says. It says, "A feast is made for laughter, and wine maketh merry, but money answereth all things." Or New American Standard says, "Money is the answer for all things." Now that's interesting. An answer to everything? You know, is that literally true, that money is the answer for everything? Well, not quite, but almost. Not quite, but almost. It really is. And with that being true, money then can be used for enormous evil, being the answer for almost everything. Or it can be used for incredible good. Again, depending upon what we purpose to do with it, and for whose kingdom it is put to use. We're told in Proverbs chapter 19 and verse 14, I've read this to you, I've shared this with you before, it says that houses and riches are the inheritance of fathers, or the inheritance that fathers give to his children, probably to his sons, because the sons of another father should be getting the same kind of inheritance from their father. So houses and riches are the inheritance of fathers. And then in Proverbs 13 and verse 22, it says, "A good man leaveth an inheritance to his children's children." Now, once again, those verses also indicate that wealth, when it's kept in its proper biblical perspective, is a good thing, and even something to be pursued, right? If you want to have that kind of wealth to be able to provide houses for your sons, or to be able to, even beyond that, to provide an inheritance to your grandchildren, beyond what you've already given to your children, you better be pursuing wealth. Unless you're born with the silver spoon in your mouth. And most people like that lose it anyway. And so, obviously, God intends. You know, we've got the other side of the passages, like in 1 Timothy and in Matthew 6. The other side, the other extreme of this position, where it says, you know, don't concern yourself with it. Don't set your heart upon it. It's going to fly away if you do. It's the balance. Obviously, those scriptures have to be understood in light of the positive scriptures, the other side of the issue as found throughout the scriptures as well. It's obviously, when kept in his proper perspective, when God blesses you with it, when you're using it for his purposes, it's obviously a good thing and even something to be pursued. Now, what's described in those two passages, those two proverbs, as it describes an inheritance of a righteous or good man? What's described in those two passages should be, for our people, for Christians, should be the rule rather than the exception. And for us to be able to do what's described therein, let me tell you, we must be a wealthy people. And yet, how many people do you know who are wealthy enough to provide a house to their sons? That'd scare some people today and say, "Hey, I want one boy and no more." Let alone an inheritance to their grandchildren on top of it. Did God want his people wealthy? Sure would appear so, as long as wealth is kept in that proper perspective. And I dare say that you don't know very many in this day and age who can do so. Most people are hoping just to make it to the next paycheck. And therefore, we are obviously doing something wrong as it pertains to the area of economics today, as a nation and as individuals. Now, although at this time we may not be able to impact the national economic state affairs, the national economic state of affairs, I should say, there are things, although we're probably not going to impact that in any great way in the next year or the next 10 years or the remainder of our lives as individuals. Nevertheless, there are still things that we can do individually to better our own personal financial affairs. And at the same time, and more importantly, there are biblical economic principles that we can and need to pass on to our children at this time, that they don't make the same mistakes that many of us have when it comes to money and economics and that particular area. That they might prosper instead of being economic slaves to this wicked Babylonian economic system that we presently find ourselves laboring under today. Therefore, I want to spend the remainder of this series discussing several biblical principles concerning personal economics. If we can take care of personal economics, if we get enough people taking care of their individual economics, and we can become, not as every individual across this land, but generally Christian people can grab a hold of this and become the wealthy of the land, we will soon be able to dictate the national economic picture as well. Again, long-range goal here. But again, we've got to start somewhere. Actually, we have already discussed a couple of the principles. Let's begin, though, by going back over those in the remainder of this message to reiterate them. Turn to Matthew chapter 6. And I want to begin with verse 19. Matthew 6 and verse 19, it says, "Lay up not for..." Here's one of those verses that, oh, it seems like we shouldn't have anything to do with money, but again, let's keep it in its proper perspective. "Lay not up for yourselves treasures upon earth, where moth and rust doth corrupt, and where thieves break through and steal." In other words, don't make those things your treasure. God and His kingdom must be your treasure. "But lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust doth corrupt, and where neither thieves..." And where thieves do not break through nor steal. "For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. The light of the body is the eye, and therefore thine eye be single, thine whole body shall be full of light. But if thine eye be evil, thy whole body shall be full of darkness. If therefore the light that is in thee be darkness, how great is that darkness?" Verse 24, "No man can serve two masters, for he either will hate the one, or he will love the other, or else he will hold to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon." I want to stop there because I want to drive that point home again. But I want to drive something else with it. The verse is telling us, you cannot serve both. Both cannot be your master. You cannot serve both. But that does not mean that mammon cannot serve you as you serve Yahweh, right? And that's the perspective, that's the side of the equation that most of Christianity has lost or has yet to figure out in this day and age. It doesn't mean that mammon cannot serve you as you serve Yahweh, or it cannot be employed to further His kingdom. Let's pick it back up now with verse 25. "Therefore I say unto you, take no thought for your life." What's it talking about, take no thought for your life? You're not to be concerned. You're not to go out and find employment. You're not to be gainfully employed. You're not to find a house. You're not to go out and gather food. Of course, it's not saying that. It's talking about do not be concerned. Do not concern yourselves. Do not worry yourselves about all of these things, as the whole context implies. It goes back to Philippians 4, 6 through 7, where we're told to be anxious for nothing, but in everything by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving let our requests be made known to God. And the peace of God, which surpasses all comprehension, will then guard our hearts and our minds in the Christ Yeshua. So that's what it's talking about. Verse 25 again. Therefore I will say unto you, take no thought for your life what you shall eat or what you shall drink, nor yet for your body what you shall put on. Is not the life more than meat, and the body than raiment? Behold the fowls of the air, for they sow not, neither do they reap, nor gather into barns, yet your heavenly Father feedeth them. Are ye not much better than they? Which of you, by taking thought, can add up one cubit unto your to his stature? By worrying about it, it's not going to happen. And why take ye thought for raiment? Consider the lilies of the field, how they grow. They toil not, neither do they spin. And yet I say unto you that even Solomon in all of his glory was not arrayed like one of these. Wherefore, if God so clothe the grass of the field, which today is and tomorrow is cast into the oven, shall he not much more clothe ye, O ye of little faith? Therefore, now keep in mind the things that he's talking about, housing, clothing, food, all of those things. He says, therefore take no thought, saying, what shall we eat, or what shall we drink, or wherefore shall we be clothed? For after all these things do the Gentiles seek, for your heavenly Father knoweth that ye have need of all of these things. Verse 33, but seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all of these things will be added unto you. Seek merely your own kingdom, your own wealth, your own pursuits of riches. And you may very well see it built, your kingdom, but you will also see it lost. On the other hand, seek first his kingdom first, and you get to enjoy both with whatever riches or wealth that he intends you to have for the sake of your part in building his kingdom. The very principle, the very first principle of biblical economics, and I can't drive this point, it seems like this should be a given for Christians, but I cannot begin to drive this point home strong enough. But the very first principle of biblical economics then is seek first Yahweh and his kingdom. Well, somebody may say, how do I do that? Well, how does a person do so with an earthly king in his kingdom? You know, if you're serving a king of olden times and you wanted to serve him, put him first, as a good servant would with a good king, how would you do that? How does a person do so with an earthly king in his kingdom? Well, he seeks to establish and expand his kingdom and therefore the laws of that king everywhere in all things. If he indeed is seeking that king's will and desires in his kingdom first. It's no different. It's absolutely no different when it comes to Yahweh and his kingdom. So here's the principle again. If you want enduring wealth, you can find wealth. There's many a man who has sought to build his kingdom and has done so. Many a man who has failed as well, but there's been many a man who has built great kingdoms for himself. But if you want enduring wealth for yourself and your progeny, then you must first seek Yahweh's kingdom instead of your own. That is foundational. Anything else is going to be built upon sand. That is the rock upon which everything else is foundational. 1 Corinthians 3:11. No man can lay a foundation other than the one which is laid, which is Christ, or which is Yeshua the Christ. That's seeking Yahweh and his kingdom first. Yahweh Yeshua is foundational to everything, including economics. How regretful that so many people want to separate things like economics from the kingdom of God. Economics is a part of the kingdom of God. It's almost synonymous to use the word kingdom in economics. They're almost synonymous terms. And if one cannot be had without the other, and thus we cannot separate the two. And if we're talking about biblical economics, it must begin based on the fact that we are indeed, with all our hearts, soul, minds, and strength, seeking first his kingdom and his righteousness and not our own. Yahweh Yeshua is foundational even to economics. And yet, how many financial seminars today do you think are teaching that? across this land. Boy, financial seminars, you see them advertised in papers, and you can buy the tape albums, and you can get all of these things to make yourself successful, to build your kingdom. How many of them have got even a foundation, the foundation right? Let alone many of the other principles that they got totally backwards of what they should be. I'll guarantee you not very many, if any, today in the secular circles, of course. Yet many of today's financial wizards are able to help people prosper, are they not? They are. And yet, keep in mind, yes, they are. Many people are become wealthy for a time, but it's not enduring wealth, but instead a fleeting wealth, as once again described in Proverbs 23, 4 and 5, where it says this, labor not to be rich, again, one of those scriptures, labor not to be rich. Labor not to be rich for your own kingdom. Labor not to be rich, cease from your own wisdom. Wilt thou set thine eyes upon that which is not? For riches certainly make themselves wings. They fly away as an eagle toward heaven. When you seek to do it for yourself and your own kingdom, the day will come when either fly away from you or it'll fly away from one of your progeny and someone else will take control and possession of those riches. You know, come to think of it, wizards maybe isn't a bad term for such people, for today's financial gurus. A wizard implies witchcraft and or magic. And as in magic, such wealth that does not have that foundation underneath it of seeking first God's kingdom, such wealth is here for a moment in time and gone for the next. As in so many things as compared to magic. Note also that Matthew 6:33 not only declares that we need to seek first Yahweh's kingdom, but that we also need to seek first His righteousness. Now, where is His righteousness found? Somebody could say it himself, and of course that's where it's found, but where else is it found? Where is it found so that we can understand it? It's found in His laws. His Bible, of course, more generally speaking, but specifically, it's found in His laws. That's the very moral nature of our God. Well, just as His kingdom is established on His laws, His righteousness is found in His laws. And with that being true, it should come as no surprise to us that Christendom has forfeited this area, along with a whole lot of other things, this area of His kingdom to non-Christians and Antichrist, being that most Christians have abandoned His laws and therefore His righteousness and His kingdom. No wonder we don't have the kingdom today. The kingdom, they claim righteousness, but they aren't even seeking His righteousness because they've abandoned His laws upon which the kingdom rests and His righteousness is found. Turn to Joshua 1, verses 6 through 8. Joshua 1, 6, verse 6, begin with verse 6. It says, be strong and of good courage. Yahweh is speaking to Joshua. And it says, for unto this people shalt thou divide for an inheritance the land, again, where there is real wealth, which I swear unto their fathers to give them. Only be thou strong and very courageous, and thou mayest observe to do according to all the law which Moses my servant commanded thee. Turn not from it to the right hand or to the left, that thou mayest prosper whithersoever thou goest. He said, obey my commandments, and I will prosper you wherever you goest. Verse 8, this book of the law shall not depart out of thy mouth, but thou shalt meditate therein day and night, and thou mayest observe to do according to all that is written therein. For then thou shalt make thy way prosperous, and then thou shalt have good success. Have I not commanded thee, be strong and of good courage? Be not afraid, neither be thou dismayed, for Yahweh thy God is with thee whithersoever thou goest. How many economic seminars, how many economic gurus today are telling their people that part of the foundation of wealth is obeying God, is seeking to do His will, is found in His commandments, statutes, and judgments. Not only is Yahweh's righteousness found in His laws. But listen to me, prosperity is built into those same laws. And not only as a blessing in generally keeping them as a nation, but prosperity is intrinsic to many of the laws themselves. Yahweh's agricultural laws, for example. How would you describe, for example, just the law that promises that if you work the land 6 years and rest it the seventh year, that the land will yield enough in the sixth year that it will tide you over through till the eighth year or the first year of the next 6 years? What would you call that? I mean, that's prosperity built right into that one single agricultural law. Let me tell you, it's prosperity to be able to take a vacation every seventh year, the whole year. Now, is that prosperity? Or is that prosperity? How many of you like to take every seventh year off? That's the way God built it to be when we do it His ways. Therefore, the first principle, once again, of biblical economics, the foundation of it. And if we don't have this right, it's not likely we're going to get the rest of it right, or even if we have the rest of the principles right, it's never going to reap all that it could reap if we don't have this foundation right. And that is that we must seek first Yahweh and His kingdom and keep His laws, His commandments, statutes, and judgments. Now, we have also already discussed what I'm labeling biblical economic principle 2. And that is, and this we won't take a long time here, but that is that we need to pursue. We need to chase. We need to hunt. We need to trail. And we need to track wisdom, knowledge, and understanding. Listen to Proverbs 3, verses 13 through 16 again. Happy is the man who findeth wisdom, and the man that getteth understanding. For the merchandise of it is better than the merchandise of silver, and the gain thereof than fine gold. She is more precious than rubies, and all the things that thou canst desire are not to be compared unto her. And then it says, length of days is in her right hand, and in her left hand, in wisdom and knowledge and understanding's left hand, is riches and honor. Long life, riches, and honor. That's what's in the hands of wisdom, knowledge, and understanding. Wisdom and knowledge and understanding are all worth more. And I tried to drive that through in the second message of the series. Are worth more than gold and silver and anything else that you want, I want to call wealth. And they are also a basic principle for attaining gold and wealth of all other sorts. Turn to Proverbs chapter 8. All right, I don't have time to read all of that I would like. I'd almost like to read this whole chapter to you. I encourage you to go back and read the whole chapter, but let's, for the sake of time here, I want to jump down to verse 32. It says, "Now therefore hearken unto me, O ye children, for blessed are they that keep my ways." Now, don't be mistaken there. It's not talking specifically about Yahweh's ways, although indeed it is, because all wisdom and knowledge are His. But it's specifically dealing with wisdom itself, which, of course, originates from Yahweh. But He says, "Now therefore hearken unto me, O ye children, for blessed are they that keep my wisdom's way. Hear instruction, and be wise, and refuse it not. Blessed is the man that heareth me, watching daily at my gates, waiting at the post of my doors. For whoso findeth me findeth life, and shall obtain favor of Yahweh. But he that sinneth against me wrongeth his own soul, and all that hate me love death." And actually, there's another pass, it's verse 17 and 18. "I love them that love me." Again, this is wisdom talking. "I love them that love me, and those that seek me early." Young people, don't wait until you're old to seek wisdom, because you won't find near as much of it if you wait until you're older. I regret And I was a very unwise child and could have cared less about knowledge, understanding, and wisdom when I was a youth, because I wasted so much of the opportunity that God had given me, so many years to be able to seek that which could provide so much more than what I have been able to glean from it in a sense. Verse 17, I love them that love me, and those that seek me early shall find me. Riches and honor are with me, yea, durable riches and righteousness. And therefore, indeed, wisdom, knowledge, and understanding are all foundational principles also for economics and for riches and prosperity. Knowledge, and think about it this way, knowledge and understanding, by God's grace, will help you to obtain wealth, and it's wisdom that will help you retain that wealth. You know, many a son lacking in these attributes has squandered away the inheritance gained by a father who possessed those attributes and who had built his estate with those attributes. Listen to Proverbs 20 and 21 in that regard. It says, an inheritance gained hastily at the beginning will not be blessed in the end. You know, just giving the silver. You know, it's an unwise father that gives a son, an unwise son, an inheritance without laying out a schedule of what he needs to be and do in order to take advantage of that. To just give it to him just simply because he's his son is an unwise father. He's gained it hastily in the beginning, and it will not be blessed in the end. Ecclesiastes 7, 11, 12. Wisdom is good with an inheritance. Wisdom is good with an inheritance. Or you could change that around. Inheritance is good with wisdom. And then it says, and profitable to those who see the sun, for wisdom is a defense as money is a defense, but the excellence of knowledge is that wisdom gives life to those who have it. In other words, No use passing on an inheritance again to an unwise son, because it's the inheritance with wisdom. I try to impress upon my children as often as I can, every chance that I get, the importance of their education now as it pertains to their ultimate success in life, especially as it pertains to the kingdom of God. The future of the kingdom of God rests upon their education in many ways right now. Too many parents are only thinking about getting their children through school instead of taking advantage of it and to use that opportunity to instill upon their children how important it is that they gain knowledge and understanding now in their lives and wisdom with it, that they can use it for the sake of the kingdom, to prosper their own kingdom, for the sake of Yahweh's kingdom. Well, I've run out of time. I'm not going to be able to finish my thoughts on this. But I'll tell you a story about, in this regard, in the next message, I'll pretty much start the message with a story from Andy's graduation ceremony that I'll share with you hopefully will drive home this point a little bit more. Anyway, we've got to start with the basics. We're going to get into some more detail about some other things that are possibly a little bit more applicable than these things. Well, I can't say that. These are the foundation. To seek first His kingdom and His righteousness, and to seek understanding, knowledge, and wisdom. They're the foundational principles that everything else that we can find in the Bible is going to be built upon. All right, let's, with that, we'll close this. Let's stand and close in prayer.